original plan tonight was to speak about the third bracha of the Shemona Esrei, Ata Kadosh. But something extraordinary happened today, and on Rabbi Lebarsky's urging, he told me on the bus home, he says, you must speak tonight about Reb Noach Weinberg, Tzadik Zichron Livracha. So I thought about it. It's not for me to give hespedim, it's not my style, but what I would like to do is to share with everyone just three thoughts, three things that we can learn from him, three things that he gave us, and three things that can inspire us. Before I begin, so a big yasher koyach to those of you that came with us today to the hespedim. It possibly was hard for you to understand the Hebrew, certainly the Yiddish. So one of the things he may have missed out was the following. The speaker before Reb Berkowitz Shlita was Reb Yeshua Eichenstein, Shlita the Rosh Yeshiva of Yad Aaron. Reb Yeshua Eichenstein is a person I have a personal kesher with. I learned by his brother, and he's my oldest son's Rosh Yeshiva. And he said something very fascinating. He said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives each generation the leaders that they need. So people make a mistake. People think that Reb Noach Weinberg, he created the Kirov movement, as if to say it was all a function of his vision. But in fact, it's the other way around. He said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided that our generation is the generation of when Mashiach has to come. He already said the name of the Chafetz Chaim labeled our generation as Ikvesa de Mashiach. We are the Ikvesa is the Akev. The Akev is the bottom part of the man, which is his heel. So we're at the very end of Jewish history, and we need to have a tshuva movement. So this is something HaKadosh Baruch Hu kiviyocha wants. So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent us Reb Noach Weinberg. In other words, it's not that Reb Noach Weinberg created the Dor, but rather HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the Dor to have a certain look, and therefore he gave us, so to speak, a gift of certain superhuman people who, as I'll explain in a moment, had incredible siyata d'shmaya, and our generation, so to speak, earned people of the stature of Reb Noach. I also want to inject over here something I heard from my own Rebbe of blessed memory, Reb Volba. Reb Volba said people make a similar mistake. They think that after the Yom Kippur War that there was a tshuva movement. It really began in 1967, a tshuva movement because of the natural effect of the huge, big, turbulent events of the Yom Kippur War and the Six-Day War, and this brought here in Israel a big tshuva movement. And Reb Volba, who was very intimately involved with the tshuva movement here in Eretz Yisrael, he said it's a mistake. It was not something that you can explain rationally. What we are going through and what we went through there in the 70s and is still happening today, in the words of Reb Volba, Zahaya Ruach Mimarom. It was a, so to speak, it was something that came from above. HaKadosh Baruch Hu willed the Kirov movement to have tremendous, tremendous success. And as I'm going to be saying in a few minutes, anyone who's done any kind of dabbling in Kirov sees and knows that it's not them. It's all HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu kiviyachol is taking our hands and giving us the ability to do the right things, to say the right things. This is all HaKadosh Baruch Hu is allowing us, as the curtains to history are coming down, to have the schus to bring people in to the other side. So I want to say over three lessons that we can learn from the unique personality of Reb Noach. And the first thing is as follows. I was zeichet to hear this today at the Hesped. Some of you saw me schmoozing with Reb Ari Khan. Reb Ari Khan had a chavrusa with Reb Noach for a year. And he works today out of Bar Ilan. He's got a shul here in Ramat Bet, Pisgat Zev, one of these places. But Reb Ari said over something that shocked me. I did not know this was true. He said in 1953, you understand this, he was still a young man. In 1953, Reb Noach decided that we have to have a revolution called the Kirov Revolution. He decided there has to be yeshivas, and there has to be networks, and there's got to be a whole big thing. In 1953, he began his vision. So people thought he was crazy. If you know your history, in the 1950s, so Ruchnius in America was on the decline. Mechitzas were being torn down, and the day school movement barely existed. Yeshivas barely existed. I don't know. Yeshiva University was teeny, itsy-bitsy-weeny, trying to get on its feet. Rav Aaron Kotler had started Lakewood 20, 30 people, yeshiva in Brooklyn, maybe Torah V'das, Chaim Berlin were just having their first beginnings. At that point then, there was nothing. There were no yeshivas in America, there was no day school system, and the idea of doing a kirov movement for the masses was considered insane at the time. It was considered so out of the box. It was like Sarah Schneera in a generation beforehand, the idea of opening up schools for girls, something that no one ever heard of. So what do? You go and get a bracha from the Gadol HaDor. So Rav Noach said, I'm going to travel to Eretz Yisrael, to the Chazon Ish, and if the Chazon Ish gives me a bracha, then I'm going to stop this. I don't care what people say, they think I'm crazy, I'm going to stop this. This is 1953. So in those days, he couldn't just get on a plane. It wasn't possible. He couldn't, whatever it was, very few people could afford to go by plane. He went by boat. He got on the boat, and he wanted to journey to Eretz Yisrael. The purpose of the journey was to get a bracha from the Chazon Ish. What happened? By the time he arrived in Eretz Yisrael, the Chazon Ish had already passed away. And he decided that this is a siman from Shemayim, but now is not the time. Okay, this is part one of the story. Then today, at the end of the Hespedim, when I'm waiting out there for the bus, I see my Mashkiach, Rav Asher Zelig Rubenstein Shlita. Today is the Rosh Hashiva of Torah Simcha, but he was my Mashkiach when I was your age. I said to him, tell me something about Rav Noach. He said, Menachem, you won't believe it, I'm going to say it to you. This is how he speaks. But all right. He says, in 1960, before I was born, it's that long ago, in 1960, Rav Asher Rubenstein was, in those days, I think he was a Hafter boy. I think Hafter in those days was called Highline. Where are the Hafter boys? Anyone from Hafter here? So, what was it called? Highline? So that was the pre-Hafter. So he spent Shabbos with Rav Noach Weinberg in 1960 in Far Rockaway. So, Rabbeinu, this is incredible. In those days, Rav Noach Weinberg, to quote Rav Asher, was learning 18-19 hours a day. 18 to 19 hours a day. He said he was finishing Masechtas and Shas and Poskim and doing Chazaras. 18, Ethan looks at me with that, Rabbi Nissel, I don't believe you. Look, Ethan, imagine, okay? Ethan does today, him and Zach do 1 hour without a break. These are my guys, okay? It's like incredible. So whatever, don't laugh, Josh. Josh and Arye, they do 1.5 hours, okay? So these are the big masmirin. He did 18 to 19 hours. How did he do it? He says he was addicted to Nodos. Nodos, I don't know if they still exist today. It's a caffeine pill. He used to knock down caffeine pills. And in 1960, he spent Shabbos with Mashkiach, spent Shabbos with Rav Noach. What was Rav Noach speaking about? His vision. His vision was that he is going to change the world. He had his non-stop. What did he say? Sleeping. Okay. No, we're talking about Rav Noach Weinberg, not you. Okay, anyhow. The point is, just kidding. Okay. So the point is that this is in 1960, this is 7 years later, he's still completely focused on his vision. So now, let's fast forward. You have 1967 is the Six Day War, and 1973 is the Yom Kippur War. So this is something, I just met Roberto Gershenfeld, Shlita, the Rosh Hashanah of Machon Shlomo, who knew Rav Noach. I just met him. I just wanted to get my facts a little bit right. So he told me something that I was completely unaware of. He says that the yeshiva Shema Yisrael was a yeshiva that lasted maybe a year. Was not Rav Noach's first attempt at building yeshiva. He had a yeshiva called Magen Avraham, which apparently was in Bnei Brak. And Rabbi Yaakov Rosenberg said, the Kirov movement, and no offense to Bnei Brak, it's not going to begin in Bnei Brak. Again, you got to move to Yerushalayim. It's not a place that's going to happen. And Bnei is not exactly a Kirov yeshiva kind of city. But the point is that there was the yeshiva Eish HaTorah was basically Reb Noach's seventh attempt. And he said about himself, the pasuk, Kisheva Yipol Tzadik Vekam, that the Tzadik falls down seven times and he picks himself up. And basically he was saying the following thing. Until he got it right, which was basically till 1972. 1972 is how many years after 1953? I can't do this. What? 19. 19 years. For 19 years, this man is walking around with a vision, this version that will change the world, until eventually he gets it right in 1972. That's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. Rabbi Yitzhak, at this point now, I just want you to reflect on yourselves, that you are all 18, 19 years old, or 20, 21? No, you're not 21 yet. 22? Are you kidding me? When do these things happen? I used to babysit for you. No, okay, whatever it was. Okay, anyhow, the point is, okay, whatever. These things happen. The point is that it's the most incredible thing that you can have a vision. I heard a story about Rav Meir Shapiro. You all went to Poland, so you went to Rav Meir Shapiro's yeshiva in Lublin. So what was Rav Meir Shapiro's most famous legacy? Daf Yomi. So when he started the Daf Yomi, so what happened was, is that many, many years earlier, he recalled a story. What was the story? The story was when he was maybe 10 years old, so he was playing with his cousins in some village in Galicia in Poland, and his aunt overheard him saying, he says, when I get old, I'm going to start a revolution in Klal Yisrael, and I'm going to start a thing that in every corner of the world, people are going to be learning the same page as Talmud. And there's going to be Achdus in all of Klal Yisrael, Chassidim, and Litvisha, and everything. They're all going to learn the same page of Gemara. So his aunt laughed at him and said, you know, you're such a kid. You shouldn't have such stupid ideas. Such a thing could never happen. So his aunt made fun of this 10-year-old child who was talking about his Daf Yomi dream. So what happened was many, many years later, when Daf Yomi was already starting to take over the world, and Daf Yomi, you know, today, it's unbelievable how it's taken over the world. So many years later, he met his aunt again, and his aunt asked him for mechila. He said, I don't know if you remember, but many years ago I made fun of your dream. So he said, it's okay, of course I'm mochel, but please don't lose the lesson that you learned. And the lesson that you have to always remember is, do not scoff a child's dream, because you never know what's going to come out of it. And what I say to you is that a lot of you, you put yourselves down and you underestimate yourself, and sometimes, you know, because there are people around you say you're only capable of this, you're only capable of that. That's not how greatness is achieved. You have to have a vision, and you have to believe in yourself, and you have to say that, you know, you can make your own impact. Never sell yourself short. Never stop dreaming. This is the thing that we can learn instantly and immediately from Rav Noach Weinberg, Sadi Zichron Livracha. Another thing that we can learn from Rav Noach. So that we said the seventh attempt was Eish HaTor. What was the sixth attempt? The sixth attempt was Yeshiva called Shema Yisrael. Now, Shema Yisrael is famous and infamous because anyone in the Kirov movement, just when I say these three names together, so you start laughing, because these were three superhuman personalities. These were three lions in Kirov. Each one of them were gedolim in Torah in their own right. To put them together in one institution, it's just unfathomable. And unfortunately, one of them is alive today. It's Rav Mendel Weinbach Shlita, the Rosh Hashiva of Ar Sameach, and the Baal B'chaim Mechaim. And then you have Rav Noach Weinberg, and you had a third one, Rav Yaakov Rosenberg. Rav Yaakov Rosenberg is Shimon Schwab's son-in-law. And these three people were all giants of spirit. I was zocha to know all three of them. One of them still alive. I know them all personally. I actually worked for all three. I worked for 5 years in Nachum Shlomo, and I worked for 5 years as a lecturer in Discovery and in Eish HaTorah, and I worked for 7 years in Ar Sameach. And people, when I tell this to people, they look at me and they say to me, "And you're still alive?" Like they anyone that, whatever, any Blavatsky is laughing, because you know the Kirov movement, if these big personalities, they were very, very opinionated. And this yeshiva basically imploded. I don't know the policy, it doesn't really make any difference to me. But the thing is as follows. They all, three of them, stood for something completely different. So it didn't work out. I'm not going to, it's very subtle, it's not so posh, but I'm going to simplify it for you in the most primitive of terms, how they were different. Rav Noach's vision was that everyone that comes to a Kirov yeshiva, what would be the perfect success story of such a yeshiva is that someone from the Kirov yeshiva would go out and do Kirov. So his vision was to take people in who come from nothing, and then a couple years later kick him out and they should go and open up a Kirev branch in some long, far, God-forsaken place in the middle of nowhere, like Kansas or San Diego. Which place have I not insulted? Memphis, okay? To go out to the weirdest of places, Columbus, Ohio. What? Never went to Memphis. You never, H never made it to Kiev. Too hard. To go to all these, open up branches and to do Kiev. So this was his vision. Reb Mendel Shlita, his vision was, what will be the ultimate success story? This guy should come through the yeshiva, and then a couple years later, you find them that they're learning in the mirror. That would be a big success story. A guy ends up learning in the mirror. And then you have a third vision. What was the third vision? The third vision was Machon Shlomo, was of Yaakov Rosenberg. His belief for the Kirev movement was not to create Avrechim and Koyo, was not to keep them Kirev. He's to create what he called normal people in what was called the world of Balabatim. So he would take in people, for example, you'd say, you know, whatever, what are you starting? You're starting accountancy, you're starting law, you're starting medicine. He took in, he created what they call the Ivy League yeshiva. It's still there in two Shalzen. A yeshiva that takes in regular people who are coming from universities, and he would say to them, we don't want you to necessarily go to the Kohen or whatever, we want to send you back to where you came from, just as Torah Jews. So you have, and you go to places like fake New Jersey, and you see all these Machon Shlomo alumni, and they all go to Manhattan during the day, and they work as stockbrokers, or they work as doctors and lawyers, and they go back home, and they have chavrusas at night, and they have whatever it is, and they're involved in the community. And this was Rabbi Rosenberg's vision, to create normal, healthy balabatim out of the Kirev movements. So I ask you, Rabbi Yisrael, which one is right?
All three.
So how do you know all three are right? How do you know all three is right? Don't throw out Eilu v'Eilu when guys just heard from Rabbi Reichman a whole shir on this. You know what I mean? Oh, okay. Okay, the answer is because you see each one of them had tremendous, tremendous Yafi Dishmaya. You could see each one of them, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them so much Tzchusim and so much Hatzlacha, and they produced so many Chashev of people. I mean, from all three of them, we have Rosh Hashivas today. It's just incredible, absolutely incredible how Matzliach all these different places are. Everywhere you go, you see alumni of these three places that are flourishing and making Kiddush Hashem. So you see that they had different shitas over there. So I want to share with you the second lesson. But just I want to say one more little story. Those of you that know the story of Rav Meir Shapiro building his yeshiva, you were all there. Everyone here remembers when you were in Lublin, you went to the yeshiva of Meir Shapiro. Remember you were there? Know that when that yeshiva was built, it was filled with controversy. Rav Meir Shapiro built a yeshiva, and no less the Chofetz Chaim was against his methodology. What did he mean he was against his methodology? He opposed the whole concept of having a fancy schmancy yeshiva. Now you take it for granted, because you're here, Baruch Hashem and Grus, we have it good. I think you guys appreciate just that. You should go to one of your friends' yeshivas and taste their lunches, and then come back to our place, and suddenly you realize how good we have it over here. But you should just know, the idea of making a yeshiva fancy was considered controversial. The Chofetz Chaim said, Torah will never flourish in a fancy schmancy place. Torah needs to be in a makom tzanua. So Rav Meir Shapiro's yeshiva was the first yeshiva ever to have a dormitory, and to have a dining room, and to have a place to do laundry. All these things never existed. My Rebbe, when I was growing up in high school in London, he learned in Volozhin, so he told us about Essenteg. Essenteg meant that you didn't know where your meals were coming. Yeshiva did not provide food at all. These are Bachrim. So they had to rely on the benevolence of local Balabatim. And sometimes, you know, a guy would invite you for dinner during the week, and you'd come there and there was no food. So you just went hungry. Or you'd have to wait hours until the Rebbe would come out and give you a sandwich. And that's the way they lived. And Rav Meir Shapiro's whole vision is that, no, we will take care of your food, and we will take care of your dorm. And if you remember, the yeshiva was gorgeous. They had a stunning library. Everything was made to look beautiful. He wanted to put Bachrim on a pedestal. And he wanted that, just like, you know, people that went to the top universities in Europe were considered chashuv, nebuch. In their circles, he wanted that Bachrim should be considered chashuv because they go to these brand name yeshivas. So he was the one that invented this idea of Meir Shapiro. And who was against it? The Chofetz Chaim himself. And it's not so simple, and you guys are all thinking, well, obviously, you know, obviously Rameshkar is right. I mean, it goes, but you should just know, who's been to Lakewood Yeshiva? Okay, you've seen it. Okay, it's not such an impressive place. It's huge physically, but it's kind of ugly. Well, you should just know that in Lakewood, there's a very pretty university over there. So I was told that that university with the campus and the grounds and the grass and the little forest in the back, and there's a lake there, that whole area, there were balabatim that were prepared to buy it, to buy that whole campus. And Rabbi Aaron Kotler says that Torah will never flourish in such a beautiful city, in such a beautiful place. That's what he said. There was Rabbi Aaron Kotler. Isaac's looking at me like I'm mad. But that's because you're not used to the whole concept of Torah. The real hatzlacha of Torah is when there's tznius. You have a look today here in Yerushalayim. I don't know about today, but when I was your age, if you asked me, well, what place had the top guys in Yerushalayim? So people would say Brisk Yeshiva. And Brisk was a dump. There was nothing there. Their whole Brisk Yeshiva was just that they borrow shuls, and they learn in shuls. It was considered, I mean, I know it's still today that way. So that was a different mahalach. So my friend Rabbi Gershenfeld once asked Rav Ruderman, Zatzal, of Neri Yisrael, who was right? Rav Meir Shapiro, the Chofetz Chaim. Rav Meir Shapiro himself was basing himself in his Rebbein, the Chachka of a Rebbe, the Rebbe of Churka, whatever. Who was right? So he said, he answered, he says, the answer is, whoever produces the biggest Talmid HaChachamim, they are right. So Rav Bel of Gershenfeld said, so who produced the biggest Talmid HaChachamim? Radin or Lublin? So he says, we can't answer that question, because everything died in the Holocaust. So then, Rabbi Gershenfeld said, so who do you think is right? You, Rabbi Ruderman, what's your opinion? Was the Chofetz Chaim, Radin, was that right? So Rabbi Shapiro and Lublin right? So he answered, like what Isaac just said, Eile ve'eya divra lekim chaim. But then he added the following words, and I want you to remember this, because this is exactly the same thing with the Kirov movement. Eile ve'eya, but it's important to have a shita. It's important that you have a mahalach that stands for something. And here's something a generation older than all of you here, except for, well, more or less everyone here, generation older, I can tell you, wherever you see success, it's because a person has a vision and they follow it through, they stand for something. So you now do not have to stand for anything, because you're still what's called in the learning stage. You're still building yourself. But at a certain point, you reach a point where you are, so to speak, you know what's called molei klimascha, your full stature. You feel you know where you're going, and then you say, this is my shita, this is my mahalach. And with the mahalach, you go out and you serve as God's army. So basically, it's the same thing. I don't know. Where's Yossi Cement? I'm sure he's here somewhere. Yossi, you could probably help me over here, but I'm sure in sports, you could probably explain to me, you cannot mix a quarterback, is that right? Cannot mix his role together with what would be the opposite of a quarterback? A what? A center. The thing called a center in football? A center? Isn't the center the tenth man in the minion? That's a center. Okay, whatever it is, okay. So some people are built to be quarterback, and some people are built to be centers. Does that make sense? I have no idea how it works in American football. What? But the point is, you can't mix the two. You can't switch roles. You choose your mahalach and you stick with it. The same thing over here. You have some people they're destined to make to do kirov this way, meaning you know they go out to the front lines and go to college campus kirov and go to the front lines and bring stuff into marriage. And then there's another shita that says do kirov by building yeshivas and putting people, making people learn Torah at a high level. And the third is to create balabatim, and each one had a vision. And each one was so passionate about their vision, and each one was matzliach because they stood for something. So that is what I consider to be the second lesson we can learn from Rav Noach. Number one, you have to have a vision, and number two, you stick to it. You have a mahalach in life, and follow it through. The third, and I think that's the single most inspiring thing. I don't know, but I believe if Rav Noach Weinberg could whisper into my ear, and I can say, Rav Noach, what message should I give them? I was lucky to have many conversations with him. Not many, many, many. I wouldn't call myself a Talmud of his. But over the 5 years, I would bring people into him, and I would watch him do his magic. He was an incredibly, incredibly charismatic. You could never argue with him. He was just a beautiful person. His smile and his warmth. So everyone that walked into him, doesn't matter how tough you are when you go in, within minutes, he could make you melt. And he made you feel chashev, and he would say to you, God loves you. He's the creator. He loves you. You know, he wants to give you pleasure. And so this is Rav Noach. I shouldn't make fun of a dead man, but I'm sorry. But he was, I can't even do a Brooklyn accent. It's not right. It's not right. He was so incredible in how he did it. He made everyone feel chashev. But if he could whisper into my ear, there's no question that he would echo the words of the Chofetz Chaim a generation beforehand. The generation beforehand, the Chofetz Chaim wrote in a letter called Chaimes Hadas, which is basically the Chofetz Chaim's letter. It is the most important letter ever written about Kirov. It was written by the Chofetz Chaim. This was before the Holocaust. And he spoke about the Tzaras of Klal Yisrael. And he gave the following mashal. He said, imagine you have a rich person comes to a village and he sees that they are drinking unfiltered water. They're drinking dirty water. He says, how are you going to get sick from this? He says, well, we can't afford pumps to be able to make, what's it called, with filters. We can't afford that. So he says, listen, I will give you the money and I will buy for you water filters and pumps for the water filters. But you have to promise me that once I give you these filters, you won't use anything else. You got to use only filtered water. You know, I don't want you going back to this dirty water. So the elders of the city promised him they would never use dirty water again, only filtered water. Years back, he comes back to the village. And to his horror, he finds that the village is on fire. He comes in, and he sees what's going on, and here he sees the elders of the village telling everyone to put the fires out using filtered water. So he starts screaming, you guys are out of your mind. What are you doing? What are you doing? There's a fire going. He says, we promised you we would only use filtered water. He says, you idiots. That's during normal times. During normal times, you use filtered water. But when there's a fire in the village, you use every water you can get. That's the Chofetz Chaim's mashal in his own writing, in Chemes Hadas. And the Meach said that, you know, that's it. We're all the dirty water today. We are the dirty water. We have to see there's a fire going on out there. He used to scream wherever he went. He said, we are living in an insane world. And the only thing that is sane is Torah. The whole world is crazy. The whole world is meshuggah. He used to go on and on and on. Beis HaMikdash is the only sane asylum. And the whole world is crazy out there. And we have to save people. We have to save people wherever we can. And he just felt that whoever can do any kind of kirov has to do kirov. Now, he was extreme about this. But one thing I can say to you, if you learn in Torah Shraga, there's no suffix that if you're not going to be a kirov professional, you will be in kirov. What do I mean? So you go into the workplace, or you go to your colleges, or you go to your neighbors, wherever you go. A person who learns in Torah Shraga, you have it inside of you because you are quote-unquote normal. Now, I've got to be careful over here, looking around. You guys are more or less normal. Unfortunately, compared to everyone else in the world, you guys are normal. That's just the way it is. And you're relatable too, and you've got good meters. Wherever you go, you have to look around you and see, can I talk to the Jew next to me and try and the car of them? That is something that's an achrayus that everyone in our dor needs. And as I started off at the beginning of my shir, it is easy to do kirov. Why? Because there's a ruach mimaro. Now, one of the things that you may have heard, I don't know if you heard, I think it was in the Yiddish. Those of you that heard the Yiddish hasid today, so the rabbi said over the most beautiful vort that he himself, Rav Noach Weinberg, used to say. Rav Noach Weinberg was in the 50s. I don't know when this was. But this was more or less the same time that I told you that he wanted to go to the Chazon Ish. So he went to the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir at that time then, Rav Finkel, and he said to Rav Finkel, here's my vision. I want to change the world. I want to do a kirov movement. So he said, well, what makes you think that people will come to you? What makes you think that we forget this? People in kirov forget that non-from people, they think they're normal. They know they're normal. They have lives. They're intelligent. They go to colleges. They raise their families. They have community. Why should they come to you? So he answered the following. He says, we say, Tzeir Tzivolanu, Moshe, Meirasha Kihilat Yaakov. And Chazal say, Al Tikri Meirasha, Ela Moirasa. Meirasha means an inheritance. Meirasa means a fiancé. Something you want to marry. So he says the Torah is compared to a beloved fiance. This is the girl that you're engaged to. So if I can show everyone wants to be with the girl that he's in love with. That's just human nature. This is the girl that you want to marry. Everyone wants to be with the girl you want to marry. So I'm going to show them that Torah is like the girl you want to marry. So everyone's going to run. So Rav Finkel said, if that's your vision, you'll be Matzliach. That's what he told him. If you're going to make Torah sweet, so that you're going to be Matzliach. And every person in this room, you should not have low self-esteem in this era. You're obligated to recognize you are perfect role models of what it means to make Torah sweet. And Rav Nach would come along and say, and says, you can do it. Yeah, you've got to go out and do Kirov. You've got to put out the fires. He used to say, he said, it's very easy. He held a Kirov was easy for everyone. He said, if you got enough money, you can carve the whole world. That's he used to say. He was so visionary. He believed it was MS. And MS is easy to sell. That was his whole thing. Once upon a time, there's a young man went to Rav Noach and said to Rav Noach, you know, I'm a nothing. This young man wanted to, yeah, what do I know about Kirov? Should I be doing Kirov because you're so into Kirov? And he said to him, no. He says, you should go and sit and learn for a few years first. And then come back to me, and then you'll be Matzliach and Kirov. So that young man, and it wasn't usual for him to say that. Very often he would just tell us to go out straight away. But that young man sat and learned for 4 or 5 years, and then went back to Rav Noach. And Baruch Hashem, that young man, he's standing in front of you now. And I wouldn't say I was tremendously Matzliach, but I saw tremendous Yachad Dishmaya. And so I have a lot of Hakara Satov to Rav Noach for telling me to sit and learn first. All those years back, it was the 30s in 1980, when he told me to sit and learn for a few years first, and then go out and do Kirov. And so I want to finish off and tell you this, that you have to believe in yourself to have this vision, and to have a shita that you follow through, to believe that you can make this impact. This is what Rav Noach taught us. You have to really, really find inside of yourself to sit and learn for a bunch of years, and then to go out. And again, I'm not pushing professional Kirov, although a few of you should go into professional Kirov. There's a few of you over here that will be very Matzliach if you chose to do so. But for the majority of you, you go out and become Balabatim, and you go out into professions, and some of you maybe they're a bonus, I don't know. But everywhere you go, you've got to go out and make that Kiddush Hashem. I want to finish off with one story. This story, I'll zecher to hear from another giant in Kirov who's not with us anymore. The zecher is from Rav Nachum Bormann itself. And I'm telling you this story because I want you to understand what Tkufa, the fact that you're living here in the year, whatever, Tashin Samach Tes, what you guys call 2009, it's a generation after the Kirov movement began. So you will take it for granted. Everyone in this room who's under, I don't know, under the age of 35, you just assume that there's an H.com, and you just assume that you can go online and press any concept in Judaism, and you'll get like 10 different websites that will give you interest in that. And everywhere you go in the world, you can go to classes. And everywhere you go, there are people that are Kirov. And today, all the different campuses are Kirov. And everywhere you go, there's people. You take this for granted. You don't realize that there were visionaries that thought this through. And you don't realize to what extent what we're seeing today is miracle after miracle after miracle. So this is a woman's story. The young man grew up in a place near Los Angeles. I can't remember what it was. It's and to the south of Los Angeles, there's a big, big community. And if somebody says it, I'll remember what it was. But he told me, whatever, this place is Irvine. Who said that? Good. That was actually what it was. It was Irvine. So he grew up, this person grew up, a young non-Jewish boy. He grows up and he goes through college and everything like that. And for his college graduation, his father gives him money on tickets for him to do a trip around the world. And I don't remember the details of the story, so you just have to forgive me. It's really the punchline that matters. But the story goes along the following lines. He was going to travel from L.A. to New York, and from New York to fly to London, and from London to Europe, and then to make it to the Far East, and from the Far East to Hawaii, and Hawaii back to California. That was the goal. And he gets on a train. I guess this was Amtrak, going cross-country, eastwards, and he's there in his cabins, whatever it is, and he's sitting there, and for the first time in his life, he sees a Hasidic Jew. Now, you have to understand something, that this kid had never seen Jews before, and this is something straight out of like of a movie, you know, a Hasidic Jew with the pants and the whole thing. So he starts schmoozing with him and sharing information and discussing and talking, and eventually the Hasidic Jew says to him, you know, young man, what's your name? So he said to him, whatever, let's say Joe, and then he says whatever it is, he says some Polish name. So he says, you know, that Polish name, I don't know if you realize that's the name of a village in Poland. So he goes, yeah, that's why I understand, my father's Polish. So he says, you know, you should just know that what's happening over here is a miracle of pure coincidence, because I come from that village. And he started asking him, he said to him, you know, if that's your family name, so, it wasn't such a big place, maybe I know your dad. So he started talking, and he didn't know much about his father's past at all. He asked, do you have a picture of your father? He said, I don't have a picture. And this Hasidic guy just like freaked out. And he said, I know your dad, because we grew up together. He says, your dad's not a Gentile, your dad's Jewish. And this is, apparently it's a true story, and I may be missing the details. But the essence thing that there was a young man who not only was Jewish, met a Hasidic guy and a train, and they figured out together that he was Jewish, that part is absolutely true. And he said, well, what am I supposed to do with information? He says, well, what are your plans? He says, I'm planning to go to Europe, whatever it is. He says, listen, when you get to Europe, do a little hop over to the Middle East and go to Jerusalem and see what happens. See what happens. So he goes to Europe, he does the Euro trip thing, and then eventually he gets on a plane and he goes to Tel Aviv, and he gets to Tel Aviv and he says, well, what do I do? See, people say you have to go to Jerusalem, there's a wall that you have to visit. And he goes to this wall, and when he gets to the wall, there's a phrase in the business that, once again, unfortunately no one knows what I'm talking about except for Rabbi Roblowski. He was Schusterized. So Schusterized means there's a tzaddik here in the city. He's now much older, but his name was Rav Meir Schuster. Rav Meir Schuster used to live at the Kotel. He lived at the Kotel. It's incredible that these Jews exist. He lived in the Kotel. To show you who Rav Meir Schuster was, that when he was sitting shiva for his own child, he asked the shaila to Rebbe Yashiv if he can get up from the shiva to go to the Kotel and try and save people, because he held it was Bekoch Nefesh, was Zeches Avelus. And Rebbe Yashiv said to him, no, you sit for Avelus for your child. But he continued and said, if such a Jew exists with such questions, I want to pay a shiva call to such a person. And so Rebbe Yashiv came to visit Rav Meir Schuster. But anyhow, Rav Meir Schuster taps him on the shoulder and says to him, you know, like, do you have the time? So like, whatever, he wasn't without a watch. And he said, what's your name? This, that, and the other. And he invited him to go to the yeshiva. Now, if I'm not mistaken, this story happened in Ar Sameach. But the point is as follows. He made a kesha, he came to yeshiva, and he made a kesha with Rav Nachman Bullman. So the story is a little crazy, because you have to understand that after about a month in Jerusalem, he stops loving everything. It occurs to him that he has to tell his parents. His parents think that he's somewhere partying in the south of France, and here he's learning yeshiva in Jerusalem. So he calls up his parents, and he says, you know, Mom, Dad, are you on the phone? So, you know, he says, yeah, they're on the phone. Okay, we're on the phone. He says, where are you? Yeah, like, you're in the Greek islands? Where are you? He says, no. He says, I'm in Israel. He says, that's just strange. Yeah, that wasn't part of the itinerary. We're doing in Israel. He says, well, I'm in Jerusalem. He says, in Jerusalem? What are you doing in Jerusalem? He says, you know, Dad, Mom, I says, I don't want to go into this, but I found out that we're Jewish. And I checked into a yeshiva. So then there's silence of the other on the phone, a long, long silence, and the mom says, Son, he says, your father just fainted. So he says, well, what am I supposed to do? He says, listen, just wait on the phone, I'm going to get your father. Father, you know, you had to get the father back to pieces again. The father takes on the phone, his voice is shaking, and he says, Son, you have no idea what a big mistake you're making. He says, you never saw the Holocaust. I saw the Holocaust. You never saw it. He started describing graphically what he saw. And he said, I came out of the Holocaust and I swore that I would never have my children go through what I went through. I did everything I could, absolutely everything I could to protect you. But he said, listen, you know, if you insist, I'm not going to fight you. So he said, you know, will you at least send me some clothing, you know, whatever I'm saying. Will you send me a package of my whatever, some clothing, some whatever, some money? Just look, not only will I send you your clothing, but I'm going to send you the one thing that I have left from my past. And that is a book that my father wrote. This is a book that my father wrote, and I'm going to send it to you. So 6 weeks later, this is all happening in the 1970s. This 6 weeks later, he gets a package from Irvine, California. And in it is whatever, his jeans and his shoes and whatever it is. And then there's this book. What is this book? It's a safer. What is the safer on? So I don't know exactly what it was, but it was a safer of London. Let's pretend it was Shirim and Gittin, given by this boy's grandfather. So it was all written in Hebrew, and he took it to Rav Bulman of blessed memory, and Rav Bulman opens it up and reads the introduction, and he basically falls off his chair. Rav Bulman says, I don't believe what I'm reading over here. He says, what are you talking about? He says, I'm reading these words, and Rav Bulman was shaking all over. He says, this was written by your grandfather. And your grandfather writes the following words. He says, anyone that knows my personality knows that it's not my personality to write down my Chiddushi Torah. It is not my personality to put things into print. It goes against my whole thing. I do everything quietly. But the reason why I'm doing this is because I see the winds of change here in Poland, and I see it in my own community. And I'm scared. I'm scared that my own child could go off the derech, and I'm scared that my own grandchildren may not know that they're Jewish. So I'm writing that maybe one day they'll find out that they had a grandfather that lived Torah and valued Torah, and he fought for Torah, and Torah was precious to him. And that's the story. And this is a true story. The details may not be true, but I don't remember the exact details of the story, but this is the thrust of the story. And you see from this story that we are not living in normal times. That everything is a Ruach Mimarom. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends us a Rav Noach Weinberg, son of the throne of Racha, because we need people like him, and we have to be Mamshim, the Mamshich is Derech. So we have to study Torah, and we have to have a vision, and we have to stand for something. And then we have to follow through Rav Noach's vision, and go out, and make our own little impact on the world. And Be'ez Hashem Yisbarach, when the curtains finally come down, and the Mashiach the Kingdom comes, we'll be able to save as many holy, precious neshamas that we can to be able to greet him. Thank you.
Shkach, Rabbi.
Shkach, thank you. Shkach, thank you.
The Shabbos, Rabbi.